While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and to our faithful listeners joining us across the region and around the globe. Welcome to Eagle FM. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are tuned into On the Reading News Analysis this Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2026. Now, as the week continues, we welcome you to another edition of the program, your trusted platform for informed discussion, critical thinking, and deeper insight into the stories shaping Namibia today. Now, this afternoon, we continue unpacking developments influencing the country's economic, political, and social landscape, with national attention focused on governance, on innovation, on investment, infrastructure development, entrepreneurship, and the everyday realities affecting communities across Namibia. We take an examination on the importance of partnerships between the government and the private sector, development partners, and international stakeholders as Namibia positions itself within an increasingly competitive and rapidly evolving global economy. Now, among the issues under discussion today is the growing role of technology in governance and public life, including conversations around digital inclusion. Now, at the same time, we reflect on the opportunities and pressures facing ordinary Namibians, that is, from employment creation, entrepreneurship to service delivery, infrastructure demands, and the rising expectations of a youthful and increasingly connected population. And as always, we go beyond the headlines to ask the important questions. What do those developments mean for ordinary Namibians? And how prepared is the country for the opportunities and the challenges ahead? And how can policy, innovation, and investment contribute to sustainable economic growth, accountability, and social inclusion? Because right here on the reader, we believe informed citizens build stronger societies. That is why we do more than simply report events. We provide context, encourage dialogue, and create space for meaningful national engagement. So every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring you informed analysis, expert perspectives, archived sound, and your voice within the conversation. Because in a world of overflowing with information, understanding remains essential. I can listen live across Eagle FM frequency, or stream us live via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app and stay connected through our digital platforms and WhatsApp channel for updates, discussions, and exclusive content. So wherever you are this afternoon, perhaps at home, on the road, or at work, or perhaps listening from abroad, thank you for choosing Eagle FM. Do stay informed, stay engaged, and stay part of the conversation. Let's get right into today's news. The Certificate in Basic Pre-Vocational Skills graduation ceremony is taking place today at Augustinium Secondary School, represents more than a school event. It reflects an important national conversation around education, employability, youth empowerment, and Namibia's long-term economic development goals. Now, for news reporting, this particular event or milestone today is quite important as it drives us to practical skills training, which are becoming increasingly important in preparing young people for the realities of the labor market and entrepreneurship, as well as technical careers. Now, pre-vocational education is designed to equip learners with foundational practical competencies before they enter formal vocational training institutions, technical colleges, apprentices, or employment opportunities. And these programs often expose learners to areas such as woodwork and carpentry, metalwork and welding, hospitality and catering, office administration and computer literacy, electrical basics, agricultural and gardening, entrepreneurship and life skills, technical drawing and handicraft skills. One thing that quite stands out for me within this list is hospitality and catering. everybody can't sit in the office and be doing one thing or perhaps be attending to office work. But at the end of the day, after a long day or perhaps after, or perhaps even for a business engagement, it's usually common that the next place, the best place to be is within the facility of hospitality, and where catering is also now given to those who are engaging in certain workshops. So it's really an eye opener for many, although it has been in discussions or been discussed here and there, but practically now coming to enforcement is something that which is definitely applaudable. Now in Namibia, where youth unemployment remains a major national concern, skills based education is increasingly viewed as a strategic tool for economic inclusion and poverty reduction. Graduation ceremonies such as this therefore symbolizes more than academic completion. They represent opportunity, dignity, productivity, and social mobility. Now, from a national development perspective, technical and vocational skills are essentially becoming, or are essential, because economies do not grow through theory alone, most definitely. Now, every developing country requires artisans, technicians, builders, mechanics, electricians, plumbers, ICT practitioners, agricultural workers, and entrepreneurs who can contribute directly to production, to infrastructure development, and service delivery. And skills development as being an economic driver is, and as we usually engage Mr. Haufiku, who says everything goes through TVET, everything that practically everything that we use goes through TVET. Nonetheless, now let's take a listen to speeches that were delivered at the ceremony and just hear on the importance of such engagement.
That's hard up region. Some are saying we are the mighty Sambesi, we are the, and all those names, we are contrasting beautiful South. This is where we come from. So I'll be your director of ceremony for this morning. As I indicated already, normally graduation ceremonies can take some time. So I'm asking you to be very, very patient this morning. This is a flagship graduation ceremony of the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts, and Culture. Many of you have only known about NUST graduation, UNAM graduation, IUM graduation, Lingua graduation. But not everybody is aware of this special, special program that we are also having in the Ministry of Education. And that's why you will also find, and that's my first alert, amongst you, you will take note that there are children with special needs that are doing sign language. So I should actually ask you not to clap hands. You must make like this. The moment that I say, let's clap hands, you do like this. Let's try it again. Out of respect. You know, that's the part of inclusive education that we also want to demonstrate this morning. The other alert that I want to give through to you is also, you see so many cameras around in this hall. We are also busy live streaming it. So that requires extra, extra good behavior from you also. Because you never know when the camera will be on you. Because you can't see the camera. And the people out there will say, why is this one now in the nose like this? Why is the one doing this like this? So you must sit very properly, silently, and whisper just silently to the person next to you. Let's do an icebreaker and turn to the person next to you and say, you look beautiful today. That's it. I want to indicate to you that you are indeed at this special graduation ceremony where we will award to graduates the certificate in basic pre-vocational skills that are evaluated on the Namibia Qualifications Framework as level 1. So this is very, very important. It's a 2-year course, and it's meant to highlight the program's growing role in transforming inclusive education and skills development in the country. Okay, maybe you must rise so that a little bit to the center. Watching your life, vocational, and life skills. And this program is designed to bridge existing skill gaps while also responding to labor market demands and promoting inclusive education pathways. Now imagine if they fall through the cracks, I can only see Your Excellency Hardap region, where so many, many children left school for many, many reasons. This is an opportunity, and across the country, this is the opportunity for them to help themselves. So these learners that have previously struggled in the traditional academic system, especially at senior primary level, can now have an alternative learning pathway. So, and please understand it also, since there are so many parents in this hall, and for those that are listening to us online, this program is not only for children with disabilities, but also supports the broader groups of learners who fall through the cracks of the education system. Now we can help them into vocational training centers. The other day, the Honorable Minister say some of them can become even doctors now in the TVET programs. So in this program, our emphasis is also very much on learner-centered teaching and practical assessments, which forms 70% of their teaching and learning. And the 30 is on the supporting subjects. And you will see that there are many, many programs that they are following, from bricklaying to plumbing to woodwork to welding, motor mechanics, agriculture. Some of you look good because of them, hairdressers, food preparation, fashion and clothing, housekeeping, educare, and office practice, and probably many more. So parents, please take note of this one. These programs are aligned with national development priorities such as the NDP 6 and the Harambe Prosperity Plan and other international commitments that the ministry have signed. So this morning, we are celebrating these children. Your Excellency, some of them have not slept last night. I overheard some people say they were singing the whole night, disturbing other people that wants to sleep. So if you find them dozing, just make like that to remind them that they are now at their real graduation ceremony. But we allow them to celebrate because this is a milestone in their lives that their parents and caregivers are also very proud of. So this is where we are, just in a nutshell that you understand it. Please feel welcome and enjoy the program with us as we continue with it. I will now call upon Mr. Imbua, the Deputy Executive Director, standing in for the Executive Director, Mr. Aitengela. Mr. Imbua, please do us the honors. Now we can say afterwards, protocol observed.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Director of Ceremonies. Your Excellency, our Vice President, Madam Lucia Bedboy, you are not new to education, and we want to welcome you for everybody. Back is from the time when you were the, I think, the Secretary for Education, Dino Balotti. In particular, the learners, being the graduates present here, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I was introduced. My name is Knox Otto Imbua. I'm the deputy executive dealing with administrative matters in the ministry. If the minister was here, Your Excellency, she was going to say, you are here today because you chose to be here. And she would have told us that you all matter. Can we give a round of applause to that? Thank you. Therefore, good morning and welcome to all of you to this very significant and special occasion, a ceremony where we recognize the hard work of our special learners. Today, we celebrate more than just the successful completion of a program. We, in fact, witness and celebrate sheer determination. We witness the right of every learner to prepare for a meaningful work and independent living, what we will call mainly as self-reliance in future. Honorable Your Excellency, our graduates here today who have worked through basic pre-vocational training to build practical skills have built not only skills but also established self-confidence. They have established readiness for the next meaningful step in their lives. Your presence here, Your Excellency, before us, and in particular, before these beautiful graduates here today, is unequivocally a demonstration of government's commitment.
Let's pause here shortly. We'll be back to engage furthermore in this. Stay tuned.
Lipura nengelo wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwa tafanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM. The eye.
Welcome back, and now joining me in studio telephonically is a founder of Ongenga Technical College, a vocational school or a vocational training college. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Elia Haufiku.
Good afternoon to you.
Always a pleasure to engage you on such news matters. Now, today we're talking about certificate in basic pre-vocational skills graduation ceremony at Augustinium Secondary School. And you know what? Something comes up to my mind to say, wait, I think do we usually really make it public when students from vocational training schools are graduating? Do we really do that?
Well, it's a new trend. It's a new practice. I remember back in the 1999-2000 there, we had a similar approach for pre-vocational training for the learners, but then it was not that popular because it was not top of the government priority. But now looking at the government policy on skills and skills development, I think the ministry, or rather the leadership of the ministry, has found it fit to stimulate the interest among the number one members of the public, the parents, and the learners to take vocational training serious. So I think even if we don't make it, that usually don't make it public, this statement is very, very clear that we need to normalize celebrating the pre-vocational graduation so that we encourage other learners to find their space in the pre-vocational subjects.
Yeah. I think also when graduation for vocational training students is happening, it being live streamed like just like other graduations, theoretical graduations from universities, it being, you know, publicized out there will encourage, when we see things, we tend to be more encouraged and motivated, to take up, skills, related courses, as opposed to, yes, we encourage people to take them up. But then again, we are also sort of like not really playing our part to ensure that it's publicized out there so you can motivate, encourage others to do the same. What do you think?
It's true. This is a thought. It serves as a motivation. The motivation to other learners who are in the junior grade to take pre-vocational subjects. Not the lower option, but as one of the top options that they can go for, just like others opt for engineering and science and geology and all of this medicine field. So this message is preparing the mind of the learners, the parents, and other stakeholders to really start taking PVET seriously. Vocational training, and this is where it starts. Back then, we knew of the fellows, our peers that were involved for pre-vocational training at schools like Engejo, Ruakana, and so on. And we really didn't have an understanding of what they were doing, because there was no clear and strong message from the politicians that, look, we need to publicize this and make it viral so that other learners and other community members and members of the public can have interest in TVET and take it very seriously. So I think it is serving as a serious and great motivation. I'm sure those that have attended and haven't enrolled for these three vocational subjects, I think next year they will consider enrolling for three vocational skills training, and we are likely to see an increase in the enrollment
to
the schools that are offering this particular subject, the three vocational training.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And also, what role do you perhaps expect from the public or from individuals? What role should we also play as Namibian citizens to play our part to ensure that, yes, skills development is something that we really play our part to contribute to? Perhaps maybe that is by also encouraging our loved ones in the homes or the young ones or whatever. But let's take it from you, the horse's mouth itself. What role do you think the general wider public should play?
The first thing is we need to realize that the everything, and I keep saying this, everything that we see under the sun is going to appear at hand. And the moment we take TVET seriously, general members of the public, taking it serious in a sense that we need to encourage our youngsters back home to consider going for vocational training, because this is the only path to industrialization. There are no two ways about it. There are emerging industries of oil, gas, green hydrogen, and you name them, and all other old industries. The best way to industrialize is to ensure that young people are fully equipped with the technical skills that will enable them to play their role in the industrialization of this world. And it's only through TVET. There are many benefits of TVET. Intensive, you name them. No parent has ever paid for a single cent as far as the registration, the tuition fee, the schools are concerned. So for the kids that are enrolled at vocational institutions. This it's very clear that our government has taken a very bold step and taken this experience to an extent that they don't want people to complain about affordability. They've taken up that role through the regulatory body. And therefore, if any member of the public that do not have sufficient information about TVET, let them please explore any other available avenues. There are many that provide the much needed information about TVET. We need to first have that understanding and value TVET. Go to libraries, let's engage any other member of the public that understands TVET so that we can have a better understanding as well, so that we enroll our kids at vocational training centers across all sectors.
Mm.
I still see youngsters at cooker shops and around the street while government has provided a very golden opportunity and an option to enroll for vocational training. But we parents and other general members of the public that have got an influence on our young people, we are still relaxed. We still don't understand. Yeah, so the only way we can stimulate the youth is to have a greater understanding, and only then we can be able to motivate the youngsters to enroll.
There's no
training institution that is better than the other, unfortunately.
Mm.
The training standard is the same. Whether it's at NIMT, whether it's at Okakarara, whether it's at Ongenga, whether it's at Balombola, whether it's at Ventuk, the training standard across the board is the same. So therefore, we don't need to worry about the rest. TVET has been taken care of, and we need
encourage our young people out there to enroll. Okay, and the message also to those who are in, or perhaps or who desire, or perhaps are already enrolled in TVET. I do hear that it's definitely not a walk in the park, because it's practical skills, and much goes into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the TVET trainees, the aspiring artisans, they have got a gold mine in their head. Whatever skill that they have obtained or that they are obtaining from that particular training, whether they are in level 1 or in level 4, whether it's a short course or a full national vocational certificate, that is a gateway to the commercial opportunity out there. There is just no way you can go wrong when you have been trained through TVET. Starting from any other level, once upon completion, there are many opportunities out there. Self-employment, number one. We do see youngsters with their small workshops here, and they only need the startup support. Otherwise, from the training institution to the industry, there is no struggle unless that person did not really pay attention and is not passionate. Number two, talking of passion, we need to be passionate as trainees. They need to be passionate about what they do and understand their role, their post-training role, as far as building this economy is concerned. They don't need to go knock on doors of employers. They themselves have got the employment opportunity in their hands. They just need to play smart and work around it.
I hear you. Tata Ofeko, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis. Always a pleasure really engaging you on TVET News.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure having you, always available, and wish you and your listeners a very beautiful afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Okay, let's pause here for now and take a trip to the marketplace. Surely we'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the R.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Lipurane ngelo wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Kono ngeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko berewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu omafelane Eagle FM.
Welcome back. In the news, a transformative public service leadership for sustainable development and inclusive growth in Africa is currently happening on day two at the NIPAM Center, a governance framework aimed at modernizing African public institutions. It emphasizes ethical, visionary, and results-oriented management in order to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals and the African Union's agenda. Let's now take a listen as they present.
So that I can be heard. So there goes my presentation there about the resilience, or why we need to be resilient as a public service for sustainable development and climate adaptation. I'm quite happy that Ms. Sirumaga, I hope I didn't butcher her name too much, from UNDP, laid a very firm foundation. So our presentations or my discussion is probably going to sound similar, but I'm going to be more inclined to a case study approach because she has already laid a foundation around the big picture. So one big issue for us is that, as she said, and I'm also regurgitating the same thing, that resilience is not about shocks of the now only. It's also about the future. It's also about how to prepare for it so that when the shock comes, you know and are prepared to deal with it. As Africa, we do know that we're like the rest of the world, where climate shocks, health threats, physical pressures are a part of what we deal with. But unfortunately for us, we also have to deal with food insecurity and also the digital disruption that the world is faced with. There's no option about whether we like it or not. The disruption of artificial intelligence is here, and we need to develop ways of either surviving it, adopting it, or making it work for us. And then secondly, We do know that as public institutions, we are expected to respond rapidly and effectively. When things happen today, our customers who are the public do not expect us to say we'll deal with it tomorrow. They're expecting us to know how to deal with it already. So this is why it's important to have ideas and plans of how to be resilient. And then lastly, as nations, we know that nations depend on public institutions to be able to survive all of these shocks. And the important thing about being a leader of a public institution is that if we are not prepared, we will not enable the world to function properly, because we are the backbone of how the economy runs, how everything runs. So we would like to see this as important as making mobile banking work. We do know that if you have to send money either to someone who's banked or the unbanked, you don't expect the system to say it is down. We expect the system to move and for money to arrive and for transactions to be conducted. This is just how we see the importance of resilience from our perspective. So just going to the definition a little bit, we're just saying it's important to be able to anticipate and respond and also recover from crisis. Someone has said it's not about bouncing back. It's also about anticipating. And we do know that when we do not manage anticipation, like we do in private sector, where your anticipation of crisis is measured through risk management, we're also expected to do it, knowing that from an institutional perspective, if we don't, we will be found wanting and our nations will not progress. And then secondly, as a matter of continuity, we do know that people do not stop being born when there's a crisis. They don't stop dying. Children don't stop becoming of age to go to school. So that's why it's important for us to know that shock does not stop life from moving on. It continues, and we're expected to be able to deliver services even through the shock. And then lastly, around being a citizen-centered and agile as public institutions, we're saying this because if we're not agile and accountable, our systems will be wanting in terms of sustainability. They will not survive the shocks, and they will not survive the future. So that's how, for us, we're saying the importance of resilience cannot be overemphasized. There are three elements that we want to look at in terms of this. We're saying ethical leadership, not only ethical, but competent leadership. Our finding is that most of what really puts us down is that if we achieve ethical leadership in terms of developing them and they're not competent, they will run after making systems work, but forget that they must also deliver results. We will have issues where people will say, this program has gone very well when it has taken 10 years to produce, when in fact it should have taken only maybe 2 months or a year. And then public trust. Regrettably, public trust in many countries seems to be going down, but we live as public institutions to produce trust or to make sure that we are trusted so that our nations can do well and be competitive and as well be able to provide services to our people. And we do know that for the most part, when people talk about public institutions or talk about government, for the most part, they will mention them as those institutions that are not able to deliver results or those whose attitudes are far from what's desired. And then lastly, responsive governance. We do know that, as you have heard, sometimes systems are the ones that make it difficult for capable leaders to lead. And it is because our systems are not responsive. It takes forever. It is this bureaucracy that we have built very well over a long time that now needs to take a different shift to agility. So those are the three, can I say, elements that we believe must be looked at in relation to resilience. And then looking at why we say it's important for public institutions to be, trustworthy, to deliver, and also to be able to have leaders that are competent and ethical. It's because we all know this. We, as the public institution leaders, drive the agenda of 2063 and the SDGs themselves. This, I'm just saying, I know you're already converted, is something that you already know. I'm saying it just as a background to know, for us to know why we do this and why it needs to be at the back of our mind all the time. And then secondly, the one thing that will not go away from us is the fact that there are critical sectors that must not be compromised. These are none other than the health, education, agriculture, water, and social protection, amongst other things. We do know, especially in Africa, that health is something that we struggle with. But if our public institutions do not have the capability to survive the shocks that come through many things, obviously our health system will suffer. And also, obviously, we will not have a future if we do not build robust education systems that are able to be resilient. And then lastly, this one continues to be a problem everywhere. And many years ago, it didn't look like climate issues were a problem. But here in Botswana, it's either raining too much or there's a drought. Something that is a reality that we cannot run away from. And we do know that our resilience now lies on us being able to adapt and develop and make a part of our planning systems processes that will help us to adapt quickly when it rains too much and adapt quickly when we are faced with a drought. And then the other things as well, foot and mouth, for example, it's something that makes it worse in terms of us as nations, especially in the Southern Africa part, that have to deal with resilience. And then when we look at adaptation and governance, we're saying climate change for sure is reshaping all our priorities. I'm saying in Africa, but I know it's not only here. If you look at Europe and the Americas, things have just changed. And then as governments, we need to strengthen our preparedness policies. These are the things that I know you already run with, but it's mostly important for us because we seem to now be facing disaster after disaster. If you look at what we faced last year here in Botswana, there were floods. Imagine a country that is prone to drought, all of a sudden going through drought. And we're saying this is what is driving our resilience in terms of policy planning and implementation. And then lastly, long-term planning. We do know that we have talked about being resilient for a long time, but now it's a reality that we have now embedded into our National Development 12 and other processes that we're now using to plan for the future. It's stuff that we realize that if we don't talk about it, plan it and implement it, we will be amongst those who are left behind as a nation. And then around human capital, because we're all human capital drivers here, at least through AMIT, and we're saying we will require digital analytical skills first and foremost, because if we don't, the crisis that we are faced with that we must manage becomes difficult to manage. Why are we saying this? We are still quite manual in how we do things here in Botswana. We're driving the digital agenda with all the verve and all the energy that we can, because we realize that without it, analysis becomes a problem. Data in terms of decision-making around handling crisis becomes a problem. Crisis management skills is what we have been having all the time, but we realize that now we need to raise the bar a bit, because the crisis that we are facing either are intensifying or they are coming in different ways from what we've been used to from before. And then secondly, around leadership development and capability, I will talk to the project that we are we're now implementing around leadership development. What has become clear to us is that most of our leaders have been working for the public service for a very long time. And when we look at our data, our executives, just as an example, in the next 5 years, a good 50% of them will have retired. And we've asked ourselves, have we prepared those who are coming behind them to function with the same competence or even better for crisis management and also for the future? That's why the program that I'll speak to is very important. It's talking to leadership transformation around succession, around strengthening how we prepare our leaders. For the first time, we're going to be introducing mentorship and coaching in the public service. We realize that we need to do it through a show and tell process, not just certificates, because those people have done, those people have attended, but we don't always get the results that we want, because what they learn without the show and tell from our perspective doesn't always translate into the results that we want. And then lastly, that our public sector reforms must also focus on things that will help us invest intentionally more than we have been doing on innovation, because we're facing unique problems and there's not much we can look to from our past that we can use to decide how the future we should look like. So that's why this investment is very important for us. Now, in terms of the transformative initiatives that we've embarked on, I've spoken to the digital transformation initiatives. This is where we want to link our national ID to everything that we do. We do know that, especially with Namibia, we already use the national ID instead of passport, or as an option to the passport, or an alternative to the passport to go through our borders. That is one, but there are many others that we are putting in place to make sure that we can become resilient and we can become future ready. And then I don't know whether Edward would like to say something in there, because my slides have moved from the center to it. That's okay. And then strengthening management of human resources. We also see that how we have done it, again, has been too certificate and degree driven instead of skills and competence. So we want to make sure that intentionally we drive skills development and something that is tangible that we can see in how people will manage the public service. And then performance management and accountability frameworks. What this means is not your normal performance management of individuals. It's looking at what we plan in terms of our national development plan and driving, together with our unions this time around, a performance management process that would look at performance of government as a whole, so that we drive our national plan to a certain or higher level of performance that we have been. We have seen that over the years, a lot of what we would plan in one performance or one development plan will get carried over in large amounts, or maybe in large percentages, that we want to be a thing of the past. So it is something that we've put on the table with our unions to make sure that as Botswana, if we think we have been performing, we believe that it was just a drop in the ocean. We must do more and must get to much higher levels. And then regional and international collaboration or partnerships. We see this more important than before. You would know that as we speak now, Botswana and South Africa and also Zimbabwe are facing, can I call it a catastrophe of foot and mouth? For us, the foot and mouth disease is very serious because we depend on beef for export and for just normal living of our nation here. And this collaboration has become even more important because for the first time, South Africa is also facing the same disease, and also Namibia is not, and they're working hard to make sure that they don't get to the same situation that we're in. So it needs all the countries, ourselves, Zimbabwe, South Africa, and also Zambia, because we also have a border with Zambia, to work together to make sure that this collaboration goes beyond paper. It actually can be seen in how we prevent this, making sure that we raise whatever needs to be raised, be it resources, be it fences, to the nth degree of what it will take to collaborate together to make sure that we survive this catastrophe. And then the last one, I think, is the one that all Africa and the whole world is driving around: data-driven decision-making. I've spoken to it through digitization and making sure that we are able to collect and make our decisions on real-life, real-time data. So those are the initiatives that I'd like to speak to. I've already spoken to one around investing in people, where we're saying, everything, like John Maxwell will say, rises and falls on leadership. If we don't develop our leaders to the right level of competence, so that we transition from speak to action and results, then we know that we would be able to survive the shocks, because we will be able to innovate and anticipate all of these things. And lastly, our call to action. We're saying, together as institutions, together as co-laborers, together as people who are entrusted with changing our Africa, shall we build adaptive institutions that will reform these rigid bureaucratic systems that have worked in the past but may not be relevant anymore? The bureaucracy is needed, but the rigidity will not help us. And also to encourage innovation and agility, because we do know of problems, but it doesn't help us when, again, we speak about them, plan about them, find resources to deal with them, but there's no activity and action that will lead to change. And then secondly, a call to action.
Okay, let's pause here now, make room for a scheduled commercial break. Please stay tuned.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USAFE stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 2 kilograms of real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only $99.99. 5 kilograms of rice cane, just $92.99. Save $7. 500 grams of U-brand 40% fat spread, just $14.99. 500 grams of right brand spaghetti, just $9.99. USAFE, where good food costs less.
Care that helps you care for others. That's the Basic Mental Health First Aid course, free for NHP members. You learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know, a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed.
To be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and I'll brace yourself for news beyond the borders of Namibia. We start off regionally and move over to continental news, and thereafter international news comes your way. And I was starting off in South Africa regarding the agricultural endeavor, speaking about challenges that are facing the farming sector, which are now put in the spotlight. Let's take a listen to that.
Farmers and multiple stakeholders are attending the Boerdery Chamber of Business Agricultural Indaba, and that's to look at the current challenges facing the sector. These include climate change, land degradation, water scarcity, limited access to markets, and unequal distribution of resources. Let's get you a better understanding of this gathering with SABC News reporter Sidima Mfeku, who is there and joins us now live. And Sidima, outline for us what's likely to come out of this meeting.
Certainly, Ayanda, this Indaba is set to, you know, speak about some of the challenges that are facing the Eastern Cape, but also to strengthen the economy of the province. You'd remember that, you know, this department, or rather this sector, the agricultural sector, is one that is plagued with, you know, a lot of challenges, like you've mentioned there, but also the geopolitical tensions are also affecting the smooth running of this particular sector. Oil prices going up, this has got a devastating impact on the sector, with you know, possibility of an inflation going up, but also that affecting livelihoods of the people, and also, you know, logistics insofar as the ability for this particular department to be, or sector to be able to, you know, continue with some of its, you know, duties. And they're saying that the reason they're holding this Indaba is to ensure that, you know, a discussion is made to sort of stabilize the Eastern Cape economy, because agriculture is one of the sectors that contributes greatly to the economy of the Eastern Cape. Like you've mentioned there, the issues of, you know, land separation, among many other things. These are going to be some of the issues that are going to be discussed in this particular Indaba. We are currently waiting to speak to one of the organizers of this particular Indaba, who is from the Boerdery Chamber of Business, to speak to us about how have, you know, this particular sector been operating in the Eastern Cape, and also as the business sector in the province, what are some of the key points that they're looking to, you know, sort of improve and ensure that, you know, this sector is stabilized and also stabilizes the economy of the Eastern Cape. We understand that the automotive sector is also quite badly affected by the fuel hikes, and, you know, this is said to have a devastating impact on the economy of the province. The ability of, you know, the agricultural sector to function at its optimum and also boost the economy of the Eastern Cape. That is basically the gist of it. But now Liesel Morris speaks to us right now about really what are they looking to sort of improve. Apologies, Liesel, for taking you out of that briefing, but just speak to us quickly about what is the purpose, the main purpose of this particular Indaba.
You know, the main purpose of this Indaba is to grow the sector. You know, we've been very, as a province, very heavily reliant on the automotive sector. But the tourism sector and the agriculture and agro-processing sector of the province is very untapped and very unexplored. So that is what we want to achieve through this Indaba,
yeah,
is to the growth and development of our farmers, you know, to get them from subsistence farmers to commercially viable farmers, and to expose the Eastern Cape potential within agriculture to the rest of the world. Through this Indaba, we are declaring that the Eastern Cape is open for business.
And also maybe just speak to us briefly about the challenges as we go on back to our studio.
You know, some of the challenges, obviously, is getting progress, produce to the market. So not the roads, the provincial roads. You know, we want our roads, we want attention on that. The provincial roads need to be redone. And also some of the challenges, food scarcity is a challenge that we need to, that we are addressing at the moment through this Indaba. Water use licenses, you know, seeing what is there, you know, that can be explored. Some of the topics that we will explore is, you know, what can grow well where. So we did some crop soil mapping to ensure that we are intentional about growing a particular crop and being intentional to connect the farmers to the market.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Diesel. We're going to definitely speak as the day progresses. We understand that the Eastern Cape Premier, Oscar Mabuyane, is expected to give the keynote address in this Indaba just after 10 o'clock this morning. Members of the provincial government have just entered as the program is about to begin.
All right, Sidi Mamfeku, live to us from Kugombo City. We'll watch that gathering with you throughout the course of the day. For now, thanks very much indeed.
Meanwhile, Eskom has threatened to cut Johannesburg's power.
The threat to plunge Joburg into darkness over a five... Eskom has renewed a threat to plunge Joburg into darkness over a 5.2 billion rand debt. Eskom issued a public notice warning of possible electricity supply interruptions owing to an alleged failure by the municipality to honour the terms of a settlement agreement relating to outstanding debt and the payment of its current electricity account. The settlement agreement was made an order of the High Court in November last year. Now, for more on this matter, we are joined by Eskom's Acting Group Executive for Distribution, Agnes Mlambo. Agnes, thank you. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Good morning, Leanne, and good morning to the viewers.
So now there's been a previously mediated structured settlement agreement that was made official, as I mentioned in the introduction, in the High Court in 2025. Perhaps you can tell us what specific terms of this mandated repayment plan has the City of Johannesburg and City Power failed to honour?
Actually, Leanne, the court order was in November 2024. In that court order, the city needs to pay for their current account and over and above that also pay the installment to the payment arrangement, which at the time it was what was owing in November 2024, and we made an agreement that the balance was going to be paid in installments, but over and above that, they also needed to make sure that their current account is paid in full. So from November 2025, the city has been paying late, as such had now not honored that court order by paying the current account in full and also paying the installments of that payment arrangement.
So let's get this straight. They have been paying late, but have they been paying? Can we get assurance that the City of Johannesburg has actually been paying, albeit late?
Between November 2024, at the time of the court order, and November 2025, they have been paying and paying on time. However, since then, they have been paying late. Mm. As of now, they have not paid their current account that is due, and as such, that is why we have now initiated this process.
Yeah.
So this has been a build-up to a problem in terms of not fully honoring their court order.
Yeah. Given that City Power had an initial 830 million rand in interest and penalties written off during those 2024 negotiations, as we say, in November, what punitive or legal consequences will Eskom now face regarding those previously forgiven amounts?
Well, those amounts were written off at the time. What it now means is that the 5.2 billion in full is now due and payable to Eskom. And remember, that is made up by the current account, which is about 3 billion that was not paid, as well as that 2.2 billion, which is the residual amount of that payment arrangement from the court order that was signed, or rather the payment arrangement that was signed in November 2024.
So for Johannesburg residents that are watching, because this is absolutely important, residents, businesses, they pay their municipal electricity bills on time. And for viewers trying to understand the system, residents pay the city or the city power for electricity, and then city power, Eskom, the city are mandated then to pay Eskom, which is not happening. And this is a very, very big problem. What's going to happen to the residents that religiously pay, and, you know, customers, businesses? What happens where basically now they are going to be penalized for municipal failures?
It is unfortunately, Anne, that this action comes across as being as punishing the customers or the residents of the city. But it is important to make sure that what is paid to the city also passes it on. We are supplying the city with the bulk, and in turn, the city invoices or rather charges their own customers for the consumption. That is why we are notifying the customers of the city of this action, because we are aware that some of them are paying the city, but for some reason the city is not passing on those payments to Eskom. So what this then means is that the residents or the customers of City of Johannesburg, they need to resolve this matter with the city while we continue to have constructive engagements with the city. But ultimately, what is important and critical for the sustainability of the system is that we are being paid for that 5.2 billion. Otherwise, we put the whole Eskom system at risk. That will not only affect the customers of the city, but puts the whole system, electricity system of the country at risk.
Okay, and still in South Africa floods leave at least 18 people dead in weeks of extreme weather conditions.
The scale of the disaster across South Africa is only now becoming clear. Days of relentless rain and violent winds have devastated communities across multiple provinces, destroying homes and critical infrastructure. The Western Cape has been among the hardest hit. In Cape Town alone, more than 103,000 people, mostly in informal settlements, have had homes flooded or destroyed. The Cape Winelands and Breda Valley have also suffered extensive damage. The response operation is now being coordinated from here, the Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Center, where provincial cabinet and disaster management officials are all meeting here to take the next response.
We've lost 11 lives. Which is really tragic. And of course, on top of that is the displacement of citizens, probably across the province, 150,000 citizens who've been displaced. There are big areas of the province where major pylons have come down, and there's a lot of infrastructure that's got to be invested in now. Bridges washed away, roads washed away, passes washed away. My estimation is that we've got around 150, 160 roads that are closed and damaged. We're opening them as quickly as we can.
Humanitarian relief operations remain ongoing across the province, with tens of thousands of affected residents continuing to receive critical support.
A number of the people that passed away was trees that fell over and killed people, flooding waters and were swept away. At the moment, I think our big thing now is to reach everybody, to make sure everybody's got food and is looked after. We have to look at, obviously, the roads now, which is a big deal, to make sure that we are able to open up roads, start repairs, do assessments on what still needs to be done.
Weather conditions continue to be closely monitored at the Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Center, and authorities are now focusing on reaching isolated families and restoring basic services. But beyond the immediate destruction lies the longer challenge of rebuilding damaged infrastructure and helping communities recover. Julie Shara, CGTN, Cape Town.
Our next door neighbor, Angola's Cabinda refinery, begins commercial fuel supply.
Angola has done something few African countries have managed in decades, built a new refinery from scratch. The $470 million Cabinda plant, 90% owned by investment firm Gemcorp Capital, is being seen as the beginning of a new era for the country's energy sector and the first real test of its refining strategy.
The Cabinda refinery is a strategic asset that strengthens our energy security, creates jobs, and adds value to the province more than a capital partnership. It is a demonstration that the Angolan state continues to firmly guide the destiny of our mineral resources in the service of the entire Angolan people.
The wheels are already turning. The plant is supplying diesel to the domestic markets while exporting heavy fuel oil and naphtha, a key petrochemical ingredient to international buyers.
We are starting refining operations to reach the parameters needed for commercialization. We are now in the processing test phase, which is a standard industry procedure.
Despite being Africa's second largest crude producer, Angola still relies heavily on imported refined fuel. Now it is betting heavily on domestic refining capacity in an effort to keep more value on the continent and break that dependency.
Angola is having refinery, like for example, Dangote in Nigeria, full capacity, and is exporting to other African countries because of the crisis that has happened. And therefore, this refinery will fuel our energy needs in Africa. Africa is a market of 1.4 billion people. We need energy.
The timing is significant. Escalating tensions involving Iran have disrupted fuel supply chains and driven up energy prices across the continent, making Angola's move strategically urgent and closely watched. Cabinda is only one piece of a broader refining strategy that includes the planned Lobito and Soyo refineries.
Our great hope is this large Lobito refinery, which, together with the other two that we consider relatively small, the Cabinda and Soyo, will deliver the long-awaited self-sufficiency in refined petroleum products.
While relatively small by global standards, the Cabinda refinery is expected to meet around 10% of Angola's fuel demand in its first phase. That capacity is set to double to 60,000 barrels per day as Angola pushes to finally close the gap between the oil it exports and the fuel its people consume. Julie Shara, CHTN.
Meanwhile, talking about another refinery, East Africa competes for multi-billion dollar Dangote refinery investment.
Well, on that note, let's head to Tanzania, where President Samia Suluhu Hassan has held high-level investment talks with Nigerian billionaire and Africa's richest man, Aliko Dangote. Now, that meeting comes as intense competition grows over the location of a proposed multi-billion dollar oil refinery in the East African region. That growing debate is over whether the refinery will be built in Tanga, Tanzania, or the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. The refinery is expected to process crude oil from Uganda and Kenya, along with imported crude to serve the entire East African market. Now, analysts are saying that it could significantly reduce the region's reliance on petroleum imports from the Middle East and can also boost long-term energy security in the region. But let's delve further into what happened at that meeting between Dangote and Samia Suluhu Hassan. We're now joined by Isaac Lukando in Dar es Salaam. Isaac, always good to see you. Now, of course, there's been a lot of speculation around the reasons behind this trip. Is it the oil refinery project? Is it in other sectors? Also, to what extent President Suluhu is open to other of Dangote's proposals and also the possible outcome we will see from these discussions. Give us the highlights of Dangote's visit today.
Well, Dangote was here in Tanzania over the weekend. He got an opportunity to meet the president and along with her some senior government officials, where they held discussions behind closed doors. They discussed a number of issues, according to Mr. Dangote, who gave a briefing to the media just after that meeting. He sounded somewhat positive about the discussions, the deliberations in that meeting, talking about his current investments and how he appreciates the government of Tanzania thus far, and some new investments, including a potential refinery, but indicating that the location of that refinery will be discussed, a final decision on the location of that refinery being made clear after a team of experts comes in to assess the port of Tanga before that decision is made. But there were a number of other investments, potential investments talked about, and this was echoed also in the communique that was shared by the president's office, talking about different areas, including fertilizer, areas like energy, port, infrastructure. Those were areas that were touched upon in the meeting of potential investments by the Dangote's companies. So overall, a somewhat positive outcome, according to what Dangote is saying and the president's office.
Mm-hmm. And just very quickly, was it clear what projects we could see coming out soon, or any in the pipeline? Did they give us any specifics?
Well, in particular, Mr. Dangote talked about a fertilizer plant that is expected to be set up here in Tanzania, perhaps to the tune of millions of dollars in terms of its values, something that was also reflected in the communique shared by the president's office, that they would offer him support to set up that particular plant. And also the president noted that there is a demand for fertilizer in the country, and therefore her government would do everything in their power to ensure that Dangote is able to set up a fertilizer plant here in Tanzania. Now, whether it is equivalent to the $4 billion investment that he has invested in Ethiopia, now that remains unclear, but definitely will be, from what we can gather so far, a significant investment in fertilizer.
Right. And of course, what is Dangote's track record in Tanzania so far? We know he has a cement factory. He's already one of the country's major investors. How do Tanzanians feel about Dangote?
Overall, very positive feel about Dangote. He's a huge investment in the south of the country, in the region called Mtwara, close to the border with Mozambique. He has got a cement plant there. He's one of the top two manufacturers in the country with about 22-23% market share. It's worth about $770 million in terms of an investment. And so far, it's been doing very well, producing about 3 million metric tons of cement every year. And so in terms of their price strategy, they've been able to integrate into the market, the local market here. He seems to be doing well by his own admission. And given what they discussed in the meeting, it appears that that investment could see even more support from the government and perhaps even more investment. He talked about, for example, making the transition from his vehicles that do distribution of his cement, moving from relying on diesel to CNG. And he said that right now it could be roughly around 600, the government giving figures around 400 so far, with a target of 700 of his vehicles, his trucks that distribute that cement, making that switch over to CNG. So quite a clear indication that Dangote's investments are here to stay, and perhaps could very much in the near future, even as early as this year, expand further here in Tanzania.
Right. Well, as always, Isaac, thank you for those great insights. That, of course, is Isaac Lukandu joining us there in Dar es Salaam.
Meanwhile, DRC Congo Ebola outbreak sparks a regional alert.
They begin in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where health workers are racing to contain an Ebola outbreak. Local officials say at least 131 deaths and more than 513 suspected cases have been reported. The suspected cases cover a wider area than the 9 health zones initially reported in Ituri province. The Congo Health Cluster said on Monday that 8 cases were confirmed by laboratory testing. Another case was confirmed in neighboring North Kivu province's capital, Goma, according to the M23 rebels who control the city. The World Health Organization has declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern due to the high risk of spreading beyond the country's borders. The outbreak is of the Bundibugyo strain, which has no vaccine or treatment available. 2 cases were confirmed in Ugandan capital Kampala, with 1 death reported, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Meanwhile, 2 cargo planes chartered by UN health and food agencies have landed in Bunia in Ituri with 10 tons of emergency medical supplies and nutritional aid.
So we're sending 4 tons of cargo here, and we're going to keep sending. We just had 1 shipment delivered this morning from Kinshasa to Bunia, which is the closest airport to the epicenter. And we'll be sending supplies from different regional warehouses and national stockpiles that had been established in preparation for events like this. What makes this extremely critical is that this is mostly personal protective equipment, which helps us in the making sure that this infection does not spread, especially with the health frontline health workers.
Meanwhile, DRC's neighbors have heightened their alert levels following the Ebola outbreak. Uganda has closed the Isha and Cheshire border posts in a bid to contain the spread. The country has confirmed 2 cases in the capital, Kampala. 1 person has died and another remains in isolation, both Congolese nationals who had recently traveled from eastern DRC. Isabel Nakiria reports.
Uganda has stepped up surveillance and tightened border screening to prevent further spread of the virus. The government has also cancelled this year's Martyrs Day celebrations, the country's biggest annual religious gathering that attracts millions of pilgrims from across Africa. Now, Congolese pilgrims who had begun crossing into Uganda have now been turned back as officials try to reduce the risk of transmission. The Minister of Health is also urging the public to avoid large gatherings, maintain hygiene, and promptly report suspected cases to the nearest health facilities.
The health teams on both sides are also engaged. They are talking to each other. What ought to be done? Should we limit the movement of masses into the country? Should there be a bit better management of people traveling across? People are being tested as they come into the country. So all these measures are in place to make sure that infections don't spread into Uganda.
To help disrupt transmission, health authorities are ramping up tracing of contacts linked to the 2 confirmed cases, while isolation and surveillance measures have been strengthened in high-risk areas. A mobile laboratory has been deployed in Bwera Hospital near Uganda's border with the DRC to speed up testing and detection as public awareness campaigns intensify. The WHO and Africa CDC are also supporting Uganda's response with emergency medical supplies and technical expertise to help contain the outbreak before it spreads. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN Kampala, Uganda.
Rwandan authorities say the country is closely monitoring the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. The health ministry says there is currently no reported cases, but preventive measures and heightened surveillance have been put in place. Our correspondent Ethan Tashobia has more.
Rwanda's.
And that brings us to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Okunana Dengue program brought to you by Peniambeko Jonas. From Indafa, happy juju. It is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful day.